From the Autoline Studios, here is your host, John McElroy.
Want to thank you all for joining us on Autoline this week. Today's show is going to be all about mobility and mobility services. What's that mean? We're going to find out soon because I've got three experts in this field, including Casey Seeley, the president of Zipcar, Peter Swetman, the director of the University of Michigan's Transportation Research Institute, and Dr. Erica Klampfel, the manager of Future Mobility at the Ford Motor Company. Great having all three of you here. Let me start out by saying this. There are some people out there now who are saying, in the not-too-distant future, we're not going to buy cars anymore. We're not going to lease cars anymore. Instead, we're going to be buying mobility and mobility services. And Peter, since you run the Transportation Research Institute, what does this all mean to you? And what do you make of this whole concept of selling mobility?
I couldn't agree more. I think we're already seeing some movement in that. So, you know, we at the University of Michigan, we track various sectors of the community and how they're buying cars, and we're finding that the younger group are not buying cars to the same extent. They're not getting driver's license to the same extent. So there's some movement taking place there already. And then when we think about where the technology could take us, I think we're very convinced that we're moving to a service mobility concept.
Kay, you run one of the big disruptors in the field, Zipcar, which has almost become synonymous with car sharing. How do you see this whole buying mobility services developing?
So clearly we're here to solve a problem, right? So the problem is that there's a lot of people moving into cities. Cities are becoming congested. It becomes expensive and a hassle to own a car. So therefore, we have a solution that solves that. You can share a car with your neighbor. You can share your car with 50 others that live within your community.
And we'll want to get into more details on that, but I want to get Dr. Erica Klampfel involved in this as well. Ford Motor Company has a 100-year history of making, selling, and leasing cars. What does this whole mobility services mean for Ford, and what are you doing with that?
So I think there's a role for a lot of the new services, ownership models. We do feel that there's always going to be personal ownership, but we're really excited about the different opportunities to not only sell our vehicles, but to help with the problems of congestion and urbanization and to get better utilization out of the vehicles that are on the road today through programs such as car sharing.
So, Peter, let me come back to you. You're Ann Arbor is sort of the center of the universe, at least at this snapshot in time, in really developing this technology with a lot of different players, car companies, suppliers, governments, and that. Describe for me and the audience as well, what's this mean, buying mobility in the future? How will that work?
Well, in Ann Arbor, we're fortunate to have the proximity to all this great technology. But also we have a great community who are very interested in experimenting with this new form of mobility. So we've got 3,000 volunteers right now driving connected vehicles, have been for the last 18 months in Ann Arbor. So and they're saying to us, well, what's next? So we're very encouraged, but we think it's an important coming together of what people want in terms of users wanting a mobility service. And the ability of the technology now to stand up and provide that in a very affordable way as well, but also to move gradually to a fairly automated kind of mobility concept.
Automated meaning autonomous cars, cars that can drive themselves?
Yeah. We think that there's going to be a combination of so-called connected vehicles. So the vehicles we have in Ann Arbor right now are all talking to each other. In a very robust kind of way, so reliable communication that you can act upon, your vehicle can act upon a signal from another vehicle. That's a huge
Give
step
us some
forward.
Examples of what that means.
So that means, for example, that if a vehicle around you is suddenly moving towards your vehicle, it's not actually in your line of sight because it's behind the A-pillar or something like that, your vehicle knows about that. So that information can be then provided to you by the vehicle. When you add on top of that the ability of vehicles to react automatically and either steering, braking, or various control actions, then we've got a recipe for a complete transformation in safety.
I.e., we may have cars that are almost impossible to crash into one another.
I don't want to go that far.
Well, but greatly reduce the number of accidents.
Exactly. The connected technology we have right now, we estimate, and the U.S. Department of Transportation has estimated that it can potentially reduce 80% of serious unimpaired multi-vehicle crashes. That's a huge number. We haven't seen any technology or any solution in recent years that could equal that.
Erica, how does Ford see this technology being incorporated into its vehicles?
Yeah, so Ford is actually involved in that project as well through donating vehicles and really analyzing the data and participating in that. So we're really excited about the vehicle-to-vehicle communication and technology. We think it's really going to be helpful in safety, as you mentioned. And also, it'll be helpful in addressing problems of congestion because you can get more density on the road if vehicles are talking to each other. They can follow each other more closely.
Now, I was shown a demonstration of vehicle-to-vehicle communication 10 years ago. And they told me at the time, oh, yeah, this is going to be in all the new cars by 2014. Well, here we are, 2014, and we're still talking several years out. When do you think we'll start to see these things in cars?
So I think the technology and the research is really there. I think we have some challenges to overcome with the infrastructure and the government and the policy. So I think through the new Mobility Transformation Center, that's really something we'll be able to start testing out.
And Kay, I got to believe this is huge for Zipcar as well, having this infrastructure of mobility.
Right. So Zipcar is part of this ecosystem of transportation needs and what people need to get in and around cities. It makes their lives easier for a couple of reasons. One, if they don't own a car, they have lots of ways to get around the city. Oftentimes, they'll need to get out of the city for different reasons, and this provides them with a very, very good solution. You know, think of it, the paradigm that has shifted from one car per person, which existed years ago, now we're looking at one Zipcar can actually support 50 members.
50?
50.
50. So that could potentially pull a lot of cars off the road or not?
So it's we do an annual survey, and our annual survey shows that every Zipcar we put on the road in an urban environment pulls 15 personal cars off the road.
1-5. Yeah. That's got to worry automakers, I would imagine, because I got to believe your business is growing.
Our business is growing, but I think it actually partners well with automakers. Ford is a very big partner of ours. Not only for having vehicles in all of our general fleet, but they partner with us on a university program. It allows users, the millennials, this important demographic for us, to be able to test drive cars. And when their context changes, for example, if they move out into the city or from the city into an urban, suburban environment, they've now tested a Ford vehicle and are likely to put it in their decision set.
One thing that I've heard is that while we hear millennials may not be interested in cars at all, when they go and use Zipcar, they want a cool car. They don't want just any car. They want a Mini or a BMW, maybe a good Ford, too, as well. But is that true? Is that what you're finding, that millennials actually do like cars?
They do like cars, and they like to pick the cars. At Zipcar, we have more than 30 makes and models of vehicles in our fleet. And we have them for a small car or a compact car for somebody who wants to zip across a city. We have cars, BMWs and other luxury vehicles where people can use it for special occasions. We have the larger SUVs, the Ford SUVs, that allow people to pack up the car and go to the beach for the weekend. So, yes, we see use cases for all sorts of types of vehicles.
Peter, let's go back to this vehicle-to-vehicle communication. Some refer to it as V2I, vehicle-to-infrastructure. Some call it V2X, vehicle-to-whatever. Mm-hmm. What I'm wondering, though, is will my future car depend on this infrastructure for communication? And the reason I ask is when the tornado hits, the earthquake hits, the tsunami hits, I want my car to be able to get out of Dodge. I don't want, you know, the cloud going down and now I can't use my car. So how do you balance those needs of people like me who want this independence with the benefits of tying it all into an ecosystem?
So I think what we're seeing here is that a big step has been taken just in February this year when the USDOT announced that they're going to move to rulemaking for this kind of connectivity in vehicles, this particular platform. So, you know, there's a rulemaking process that takes 2 or 3 years to move through. But I think that was the signal that you mentioned earlier, the 10 years ago we were seeing certain things. And I think that is the big news. That is the thing that's going to help move, the catalyst that's going to move all this forward. But it's not only the fact that we've got this platform in vehicles, original equipment, but we, as you rightly allude to, we do need connectivity in the infrastructure as well. So one of the interesting questions is how that's going to be paid for. What's the business case in the infrastructure? So it truly becomes a public-private partnership. And I think that's why the government, the USDOT, has taken a strong role in kind of guiding this process, because you've got to start somewhere. You can't suddenly just create that partnership out of thin air. So I think we've come a long way in the last year or so.
And you anticipated my next question, which is, who is going to pay for this? Now, you've got a great program going in Ann Arbor with a lot of corporate and U.S. federal money going into it. But if this is going to scale up, where will the money come from?
So one reason that we've pursued this particular technology is that it's very affordable. So the communication between the wireless communication is much more affordable right now than many of the sensors that every vehicle would have to have.
So there, isn't this Wi-Fi essentially that you're using for communication?
It's a licensed form of Wi-Fi spectrum, and so we're very pleased that spectrum has been reserved for these safety purposes. We need to make sure that it stays that way and we take full advantage of it, because this is a very affordable way to create this kind of what we call situation awareness. Your own vehicle creates its own situation awareness of all the vehicles around it. How good is that? So if that's affordable and we're not needing a lot of sensors in all of those vehicles in order to do that, then this is a pretty smart way to do it.
When you say hopefully you'll get that spectrum, isn't one of the dangers that some in Congress are talking about auctioning off that spectrum and making some money off it?
Indeed. So that spectrum is highly valuable, obviously. But we're now moving so quickly with these safety applications that we think it's important. And we believe that that all the parties involved in this recognize that safety is obviously critical, and we need to either reserve that spectrum or at least make sure that whatever other uses are being permitted, either in the spectrum or adjacent to it, are not going to interfere with the way this operates. And one of the great things about our test environment in Ann Arbor is it's the ideal place to test all these kinds of things. So at the moment in Ann Arbor, we have, at any given time, probably 5% of the vehicles in the traffic stream are actually equipped with this technology. Even though we've got 3,000 out there, they get diluted in the traffic stream. But what we'll be able to do as we go forward with our new center is bring many thousands of vehicles into the picture and see what happens when we have a really high density of vehicles broadcasting. And that's when we have to make sure that we have the spectrum that can accommodate that volume of messages going around.
So I just want to say, I don't think you have to worry about being caught in a tornado. You can think of this as an additional safety feature that complements the current functionality that you have in the vehicle. So to address your first point. And I think when policy and government thinks about how will we pay for this, we should think about all of the trade-offs that we get from the safety perspective and the collision avoidance. The government spends a lot of money on this sort of thing, which leads to accidents and high healthcare costs. So I think there are a lot of trade-offs in the cost that we might pay for this and what we gain as a society.
Erica, do you think that might be able to come out of insurance premiums? I mean, presumably, if you've got the technology that will get you in many fewer accidents, maybe no accident whatsoever, you'd save a ton on insurance. Couldn't the insurance companies give you discounts if you have that on your car?
I wouldn't want to speak for what the insurance companies would do.
But you kind of like the idea, maybe.
So I think there are a lot of new business models and opportunities that will arise out of the new technology.
Can you talk about when we might start seeing Ford putting this technology in its cars?
So as far as timing, I think we're really interested in looking and exploring with the new MTC, with U of M. I think this is where we're going to be able to test out a lot of the technology really in higher density with the center. So we're really looking forward to that.
And Kay, is Zipcar looking at incorporating this technology in the cars it offers?
Absolutely. A lot of what we do, there's a couple things we do. One, first and foremost, is we look for what will make our member experience better. And with all the technology going into cars, whether it's safety features, whether it's, you know, automatic braking system so you don't cause a collision is not caused, that's all good for our members. And then if we can create new products and services that allow for the car to be more efficient, it's better for our members, therefore it's better for us.
Talk a little bit about the total car sharing business. And the reason I ask that is recently Daimler just announced it had its own car sharing program called Car2Go, but it's pulling out of the UK market. Meanwhile, elsewhere in Europe, it's going pretty good, but it pulled out of the UK. And Uber, which is kind of car sharing where you get a driver too, is talking about doing an IPO that may value the company at $10 billion. So, you know, here's one operation pulling out of an entire country and another one talking about fabulous IPO.
Right, right. A couple different applications. First of all, I think Uber, part of the ecosystem of this whole notion of mobility, they're a reservation system. They don't own cars. They don't own drivers. They are a good service that provide an option for people to go from point to point. And they're growing very nicely, so that's good. Zipcar, we have a couple different services that we offer to members, which is different than what our competitors do, whether it's Uber or Car2Go or others. And that is that we have a round-trip service with guaranteed parking on the end of the transaction. And that is very attractive to people. I already spoke about we offer many different makes and models of vehicles. That does not exist with Car2Go. We continuously roll out new technology and new services that our members have been asking for. And so it's a good business that a lot of people are asking for, and that's why we continue to grow around the world.
Parking. Peter, I got to ask you about that. Kay's absolutely right. You know, parking, especially in urban environments, can be a major hassle. Is identifying parking spots part of your program?
Absolutely. So the new center that we alluded to, the MTC, smart parking is definitely part of that because right now in a city, any given city, if you're looking at all the vehicles traveling around the streets, maybe 30% of those vehicles are just circulating around looking for somewhere to park. So this is a critical item. And there are many ways we can look at this, but we see that certainly in the foreseeable future, very immediate future, we're going to see cars that park themselves, for example. So that's going to make a huge difference to the efficiency with which the parking structure is being used because we don't need nearly as much space within the parking structure. If you and I are trying to back in and out and so on, and I just backed into a colleague the other day in the parking lot. So, you know, we get away from all those kind of problems with that sort of automated parking situation. So I think they're some of the things that will be very early adopted in our program.
Yeah. I think if I can jump in on that really quick, the notion of making sure that there is parking is important not only for the people driving but the cities. So there is this notion of does it create 20 or 30% more congestion if you don't have a spot at your destination is remarkably important as cities decide what sort of transportation systems they put into place.
How do you do that? Do you have to put sensors in every parking spot or parking meter? How does that work?
Well, I think that's certainly being done. So, yes, very low-cost sensors can be put in every parking spot. That information can be beamed to the vehicles. So that's happening. But also this V2V and V2I technology can be used that way so that you don't necessarily need to have a sensor in every parking spot. So you can actually see, the vehicle can see what's going on. So there's a lot of development to take place there. Smart parking, I think, is an area that's just taken off in the last 2-3 years. You know, when we think about all of the possible areas of intelligent transportation systems that can be implemented, I think smart parking is one of the more exciting ones and one of the most successful ones.
I think Audi's got a program in San Francisco on this very thing, where with your navigation system, you can identify where there's a parking spot in the city, and it's dynamic. So if somebody goes and takes it, it'll show you the next available one based on where you're going.
Exactly. And I think, as Kay said, customers are going to be starting to expect this kind of thing. You know, so it's going to be very easy to get used to having that. So
yeah, as you mentioned, there are a lot of different technical ways of doing it by using sensors. One of the interesting experiments that we did in London was to open up using our OpenXC, open software and hardware platform, to the community to see in London. It was called the London Traffic Tamer App Challenge, to get the community to see how would you address the challenges in the city and what can you come up with developing it using this plug-in device that's open source. And the app that won was called Park App, Appy Park. That was it. And it was, so in London, you mentioned the complexities of putting sharing or something in place in London. Well, there are so many different boroughs. They all have different pricing, parking rules and regulations. So the Appy Park brought all of this information together for one parking and payment system.
So. That's pretty good. And you just threw that open to the public to develop,
yeah.
Eh? That's really impressive. You mentioned London. I want to ask you about this program Ford's got in Chennai, India. I think it's called Summers, Sustainable Urban Mobility with Limited Rural Reach. Is that right? Did I get that right?
I think so. I was hoping you'd say it and not have me do it.
Yeah. What's that all about?
Yeah, that's really actually, I think, a really nice program around getting maternal care and health care access to women in rural areas by providing a vehicle that can handle the terrain and the connectivity to get the women to safely deliver pregnancies. So
this whole concept of mobility is something that Ford is very focused on.
Yeah, you can think it started back in 1925 when Henry Ford had the advertisement campaign around opening the highways for all mankind, and it was really about providing affordable and accessible transportation for all. And I think that's really permeated through all of Ford's history. Right now, I think we're at a changing point of how we actually deliver that to our customers based on, multimodal transportation and different ways and ownership models. So now we're really looking at how can we provide seamless mobility for all.
Very interesting. Yeah. And I love hearing that you're experimenting in rural India with this kind of a concept. How amazing, really. Kay, let me come back to you. You do this car sharing, you know, where people have to join Zipcar, become members to use it. But there's some other models that are developing out there, too, where individuals can put their own cars in for vehicle sharing, like through relay rides mm-hmm. with OnStar. And then there's even talk of maybe people just getting online and doing their own peer-to-peer kind of connection. How do you think this is going to develop? What's the end game in all this?
So I'm not going to predict the end game. It gets quite a bit of attention. Certainly any peer-to-peer sharing, whether it's vehicle or other services or products that people want to share. In the transportation space, we're focused on not the peer-to-peer space. We're really focused on making sure that there is a car for a driver and not having that peer-to-peer concept.
Mm-hmm. So how's business?
How's business?
For Zipcar.
Our business is going very, very well. Fastest growing segment is our university segment. The students in university, obviously a car, very expensive and a hassle to park on universities. So growing by leaps and bounds. We're on over 350 campuses in North America alone. We continue to expand. We're in hundreds of cities and towns in the countries that we exist. And we continue to see our membership rise.
Where's it most popular, the concept of car sharing?
So how we start out is...
I guess I'm asking by country or geographic region.
By country. So in North America, we started in North America in 2000. So we have a longer history here. Zipcar has a longer history here in North America. So we have more members here, but we do continue to see significant growth in Europe.
I would think places like Europe, Japan, China, and the like, too, much more urban concentration, that it would be even more popular in those kind
right.
of places.
You know, easy places to introduce is where the cost of transportation is high, where public transportation is used frequently, where the cost of living is high and there's a high density. And that's where we focus. London, we're very, very successful in London. We have a couple thousand cars in London and thousands of members and that enjoy our service today.
So Car2Go had to pull out of the UK, but you're going strong.
That's
there.
That's right.
Real good. With that, we're going to have to wrap this up. I mean, we could easily go on another hour talking all about this. I think it's one of the most exciting developments that's ever come along. But Kay Seeley, the president of Zipcar, Peter Swetman, the director of Umtree, and Dr. Erica Klompfel, the manager of Future Mobility at Ford, I want to thank you all for having joined me today.
Thank you.
And I want to thank all of you for having tuned in.